Hello and welcome to recording number 42 of Gary Gygax's Saga of Old City, an annotated reading. Today is July 23rd, 2021. We're pretty close to the end of the chapter here. I was a little sorry not to be able to reach it yesterday, but it just was going on, getting a little late. We're right in the middle of a combat scene. Gord, Curly Greenleaf, and Chirp have gone off into the Aberall's Mountains, and they found the Karn, which they were looking for, that Curly wasn't even quite sure that they were going to find. And Curly has charmed a monstrous cave bear to aid them. And they have opened up the Karn, and as they came inside, they've been attacked by some kind of zombie. And I say some kind of zombie because it seems like it's exceptionally powerful. All right, Gord has been struck. The bear has been struck. And I'm going to start here on page 310, second paragraph. "To your grave, damn thing," Chirk cried as he came up behind the creature and brought his great battle axe down. Because of the low ceiling and the closeness of the melee, the blow could not be delivered with full force, but it was still strong enough to send the blade through the steel plate and chain mesh, protecting the undead thing's shoulder. The barbarian's blow did not fell the zombie, but it threw the thing off balance so that the mace it wielded swished through empty air. As it exposed itself thus, Curly Greenleaf jabbed his spear forward, scoring a hit on the zombie's rotting body. "This thing is tough," he shouted to his companions, ducking another swing of the undead cleric's rusty mace. The bear growled hideously, but the crowded conditions did not permit it enough space to attack fully. Jorg had spit out the moldering member from his mouth, shaking it free, and then trying to clear the foul taste from his mouth. Gord had moved back and was also out of the fight for the moment, trying to clear his vision and staunch the flow of blood that was running down from the wound on his head and blinding him. Chur and the druid continued to press the zombie so that it could do naught but face them in return. If the damage done to its undead body caused it pain, there was no evidence of it. Gaping jaws still sounded its silent scream, lambent hatred burning in its eyes. The zombie sought to crush its foe with the weapon it had used in life. "When I stab it, you strike it from the side," Greenleaf shouted, as he dodged another swing of the iron mace. Then he thrust his spear forward into the thing's body once again. The barbarian gave a cry that sounded like brr as he swung his weapon in an arc perpendicular to the zombie's body. With both of his hands clasped on the half of the great axe, his teeth clenched, his muscles working to their fullest, Kurt drove the blade hard and true, hitting the thing at the waist just as the druid yanked his spear out of its torso. The curving blade cut the rotting thing nearly in half, and the zombie fell back and down. The thing twitched and jerked, but it did not stand upright again. Its lolling head showed only empty eye sockets where the evil light had burned a moment earlier. Then the air was filled with the sound of a deep, dry chuckle coming from the interior of the Karn, so pervasive that it seemed to flow right down through the stone itself. It was the most evil sound Gord had ever heard. "Jurg, guard the doorway there," the druid said, following the words with a gesture and a few guttural sounds. The bear complied, moving next to the opening on the back wall that the zombie had come through. Curly turned and surveyed his friends, a thin smile on his lips. Well, that's that, he said. Now, Gord, let's take care of that gash on your head. Gord had overcome the dizziness that beset him when he was hit, had managed to clear the blood from his left eye with a piece of linen torn from his undershirt, and was dabbing at the wound. The druid moved him near the entrance and peered at the cut in the light there. It's not a serious wound, he said, but who knows what foulness was on that mace. I'll have it taken care of in a moment. The young thief watched as Gord took a small jar from his belt pouch, opened it, and with a bit of clean cloth, took out a small potion of the amber-colored ointment therein. The stuff made his skin tingle when the druid applied it to the wound. The cut stung briefly, and then all pain was gone. A small moan of satisfaction escaped Gord's lips as the magical medicine finished its work. "The wound is closed, my friend," said Curly, "and your forehead is as good as new, except for a small scar you'll have there. Clean off the rest of the blood, and we'll be ready to get on with this business." The druid turned back inside the chamber then and saw the barbarian examining the remains of their foul and unnatural foe. "Hey, Curly, what kept this thing going?" asked Chert as he wiped the blade of his weapon on the creature's tattered garments. "It looks as if it's been dead for years." "Zombie," Greenleaf asked rhetorically. "No doubt some malign power desired to keep the corpse animated with wicked force to serve as slave." "That was no ordinary zombie, though. I've encountered a few of these undead in my travels, and this one was far worse than any of the others." Blake. So this is another example here of Gygax, doing something and then later explaining it. Because, you know, this is what has been on my mind, and it's been commented on, that this is no ordinary zombie. Here it is, taking on three high-level characters and a monstrous cave bear. And a regular zombie would have been torn to shreds at this point. Also, Gord is, a fairly hard character to hit, with advantages in dexterity and magical armor. So, you know, this was some kind of exceptional zombie. I don't think Gygax quite explains it in AD&D terms. Now, again, it was an example of combat, but it doesn't bear, quite the example of pure first edition AD&D without some alterations here, because we have against Gord what is really a kind of critical hit that unless it's a special ability of the zombie, he's stunned, he's got a head wound, he's partially blinded, and, you know, this is that's not a common thing. It is very good for, expressing the story and, describing the combat, making it interesting, but it is a little out of the ordinary there. Otherwise, one of the things, offhand, I can't remember with a druid whether it has the ability to turn undead, that class.
They do not.
Excellent.
No, right. I checked it out, and I was like, why isn't he turning undead? But it appears that they don't. At least right. Not in first or second edition.
Okay, so that's excellent news, because, I do wonder that Gygax is really, this book is really describing the mechanics of AD&D. And I've heard commentary, you can hear the dice rolling as if it's some kind of negative thing. But really, you can't really hear the dice rolling, but what you're seeing is the combat expressed in a narrative, dramatic form that then can be cut out and used by a DM or even a player to liven up what can be a very boring, I roll the dice, I hit or I miss, which can get very boring and repetitive, like a game of Risk describing your various dice rolls.
I haven't found this boring at all. Not this whole portion.
Yeah, this has been a very good setting. You know, he set things up very well, and the combat follows AD&D combat, and yet it's exciting. It's, it's dramatized version of it, and it works very well. And so Gygax isn't just dropping. He's not just going and saying, well, AD&D, you can't describe the combat. It's going to be boring, so I'm going to do this. Which, when they had the later books, the people weren't familiar with the rules at all. And they just did whatever, whether it made any sense or not. And it certainly wasn't expressing AD&D. So with this, I'm always pleased that Gygax is showing us how we can take, it's because the book is a living example, and it breathes life into setting material. It breathes life into the mechanics. When Gord is using the thieving ability in Stoink, that was an exciting thing with him hiding in shadows, climbing the walls, and showing that, the thief can act in a very James Bond kind of way. So it's really nice to see how the combat's expressed. Now, it implies here that Curly hasn't had experience with zombies.
This particular type.
Well, no, I kind of think maybe.
He says he's encountered a few.
Is it? Oh.
Yeah, yeah. He says, I've encountered a few of these undead in my travels, and this one was far worse than any of the others.
No, it's Chert, I mean. I'm sorry. It's Chert who doesn't seem to have encountered. Yeah, because he's saying, what keeps it going? It looks as if it's been dead for years. So I would guess then that the zombies would be a very rare creature to find in the Adre Forest. Because that's primarily where Chert has spent his life so far. Now, we also get an example of a healing ointment. Rather than a healing potion, but we get the healing ointment right here. That is a nice way to describe the effects of a healing potion. It should be noted, because I've heard this conversation before, it should be noted that it's going to leave a scar. So, the healing potion, it seems to be working like natural healing that is speeded up into a moment, but at the same time it's not like a complete restorative, so that it's even taking, it's knitting the flesh together, but it is not taking care of the wound. It's
make
not
him feel good.
Yes, and I've always liked that. I've done that with my own description of healing, like healing spells. I describe it as some kind of fair-colored light, golden light, a bright yellow light or a bluish light, that comes over them. Done different things about drinking a healing potion, and expressed it differently from the various an ointment, a spell, a potion, how that worked and how that is described. And part of that, I've always described that it made the person feel good.
It was interesting that he noted that it was amber colored.
Yes. And, these are little bits of lore. And that is my primary focus in my commentary. My primary interest really is the lore. We have a little things here about the story and that like the sense that Chert hasn't, for his character, he hasn't encountered zombies before. But in a wider sense, then that as a well-experienced barbarian of the Adre Forest, then that goes on to say that, you would not be encountering zombies very often in the Adre Forest. And so you can add that to, a little bit of the lore from Gygax's point of view. And, like in all things, you can use that or not use that. But, you know, that works out well with me. I mean, I don't know why, what would be in the Adri Forest to have zombies at this point, you know, especially with a big community of woods folk who would likely destroy any that were about in a woods that is protected by, you know, a sect of druids right there.
And Sylvan elves.
Yes, yes, that's true. You know, there's also the Sylvan elves of the Adri Forest. And I would sense that the river folk are, you know, they just must be the communities based upon the Harp River. You know, because otherwise, I don't know what else you would call them. You know, maybe there's some up further on the Teaser Torrent where it splits, but that really wouldn't be, I don't think, mentioned by the woods folk of Adri as the river folk of the Adri Forest. I am still surprised that Woodsford wouldn't have had a little, some kind of little village or an inn right there at the crossing.
Yeah, it would make total sense.
Yeah. Especially over a wide shallow place. And that, of course, that's us jumping back to the Woodsford, the Battle of Woodsford and the description there. And it does seem to say to me that that forest road, especially as it's going out toward the you know, it's headed toward the Great Kingdom, and then, you know, north to Nurl, and then south, you know, I what is it? What is
Inspa.
It? Yes, it would lead.
Yeah, it goes south, and it turns, I think, and it goes around. And I don't think Inspa's on the river, but it's pretty close.
No. Inspa's further to the west.
Okay.
Inspa's within the hill country. Inspa was 3 days of hill travel, where the flinty hills are wooded by the Adri Forest. And Inspa, you know, is 3 days west into the hills there. Or at the, you know, some nicer area. In fact, I think I remember seeing it mapped as a clearing within, you know, like an area on the western edge of the Adri that had like a little clearing, cleared area by Anna Meyer's map. And of course, you know, Darlene's map is too big a scale for to show such kind of detail. All right.
There are two things I liked nice strategically here. We had an example of Curly and Chert fighting together. So that was interesting. Like, there's the one attacked, and then he backed off, and then Chert came in and had that massive swing with his axe. And the fact that they posted Jurg as a guard, just to make sure while they recovered, you know, that if anything else came, they would be alerted.
And the last thing, you know, in a technical, you know, aspect is that the cleric's body was clad in plate and chain. And, you know, that is something that isn't addressed in the 1E rules, where, you know, wearing double armor, you know, like padded armor. Usually, what you would wear is plate, chain, and padding, or chain and padding, to protect your body from the rough iron links or from the plate.
Yeah, it would chafe.
And then even leather armor might have padding under it, because, you know, we talk about one of the armors as padded leather armor, and that is a, you know, an inner thing. And some characters would wear nothing but the padding because they did not have the leather armor had to be crafted. And, you know, not every farmer is going to be able to have, you know, either leather or metal armor. And I've always thought, you know, there should be, you know, some kind of, based on how the AD&D system seems to be about how the armor, you know, the greater the armor, the more protection you have, that it should be mentioned that there should be a combination of, you know, whereas in first edition, plate mail is armor class 2. And that I would say that if you were wearing plate and chain, it should at the very least give you another one. It should make you like armor class 1 or armor class 0. But, you know, that is non-magical. And I think that for the system, they did not want to reduce, you know, for just general, you know, troops in good armor. I don't think they wanted to make them that hard to hit. But it would make sense that chainmail under plate mail would make them harder to damage. I mean, realistically, if you know, combat in AD&D is symbolic. It's not one blow is an actual hit, or every arrow you know is stuck into somebody. It would make sense that you're easier to hit wearing plate, but harder to damage. But there's no, you know, there's no system in place for that. All right. I am going to restart right here. We're very close to the end of this chapter. And it is page number 312 and paragraph 4. Whatever. The thing went down easily enough when kissed by Bruhl here, barbarian giant said as he hefted his huge axe. Bruhl, you say? An interesting name for an axe, said Curly. I detected a low hum coming from it as you felled the zombie with that last stroke. Why have I never heard you call it by name before now? Kurt grinned at the druid. This has been handed from father to son in my family for generations. I named it too without thinking, and now you know its secret too. When called by name, the weapon strikes true and sinks deep, as if it were alive. Perhaps it is, or perhaps it carries a deomer. I neither know nor care. It is a true friend, tried and trusted. Indeed, a friend of us all, Gord chimed in. He had finished cleaning himself up and rejoined the group. Curly Greenleaf nodded knowingly and spoke no more about the matter. He turned his attention to the bear just as Yurg let out a low rumble. Break. So, you know, this is actually handy to know that Chirp possesses a magic axe. It's interesting to hear its activation. It's a name-activated weapon. And a lot of times... you know, I noticed that a lot of magic weapons are colorless. Oh, it's a +3 axe, and it has no life or flavor beyond that. And I always think that if you have a, you know, a magic weapon, that it definitely should have characteristics, you know, either physical characteristics, showing certain, you know, runes or certain things, or names showing where perhaps to hide its secret, but like this with the word activation, and in here, you know, it gives emits a hum, it strikes deep and true. You know, I don't know if it means that it actually is, because this is from Church's point of view. And so whatever is said, and this has been spoken of, I've read in coming up, we've said it, and it's being talked, referred to in on Cannon Fire Discord right today and yesterday, is the idea of an unreliable narrator. And so rather having an omniscient narrator who says things and they are true, we have throughout this book, you know, things that Geller says, things that Gord says, things that Church says, and you can't, from whoever is saying it, is from a point of view that may or may not be correct. You know, if we jump back to the early book, setting books, the Folio and the 83 set, they are both books that are from an unreliable narrator who has his own biases and beliefs, and that makes them so much better for that a DM can use them or not use them and just say, well, you know, this is a setting that is supposedly written from the point of view of someone from the far, far future. And they are not going to be 100% accurate if you don't want them to be, or they could be exactly right. And I think that is a vast improvement over the idea that whatever is said is supposed to be exactly that way.
How he's describing it, it seems like he calls its name and it crits.
Yes, and because if you notice the description of the combat, the axe almost severs the body of the zombie in two, which is more than you would get in a normal explained combat situation. And I know later on, you know, they introduced critical hits and bad misses as an article in Dragon Magazine. And this was written in 85, so I just wonder if Gygax, in looking at the rule system and in this story, is definitely using, you know, critical hits. It is, you know, it is interesting to see that, you know, we're probably looking at a growth of the rule system by the time he was, you know, writing this book. And so the story, I think, when we see called shot, things that are like Gord calling for a certain kind of strike on an arm, or I think we're looking at crits, fumbles, and we're looking at called shots. And I, you know, I think that this is showing the addition to the game system. And one of the things, I don't think, you know, the later additions, they mostly seem to be for a way to make money. Because I think all that was needed for first edition was the ability to offer options. You know, at the very end of second edition, they came out with these rule books called, you know, combat options, various option books. And I don't think they ever needed to make the customers, make the DM and players have to buy an entirely new edition. I think all they needed to do was keep the first edition and then add things. Well, do you want to play with skills, you know, non-weapon proficiencies? And then later on, do you want to add feats? Do you want to add, you know, various things that they added? Do you want to change, you know, how armor class, how combat is used? And I don't think anything I've seen from any of the editions warranted a complete rewrite from the first edition rules. I think it mainly was, you know, what was said about third edition by people like Ryan Dancy, that they made their money from selling the rule books, not from selling the adventures. And so by coming out with, you know, a third edition, it forced everybody who wanted to, you know, keep up with what was being published to, for everybody to buy a new player's handbook, for at least the DM to buy a DM's guide and splat books. And, you know, so they were making their money, but I think that's why we saw third edition, 3.5, fourth edition, and now fifth. And I think whether fifth is well-liked or not, at a certain point, they're going to come out with sixth edition. I just think that's how they make a sudden influx of money. All right, so, you know, again, I think we're seeing a very nice, you know, addition to what the rule systems were when AD&D first came out. All right, I am going to restart. It's page 312, and we are at the fourth paragraph from the end. Curly Greenleaf nodded knowingly and spoke no more about the matter. He turned his attention to the bear just as Yurg let out a low rumble. "Our friend senses the presence of something else awaiting us inside," said the druid. "Now it is time to go down and see what that is. May our weapons prove potent and our enemy be confounded." Break. Just to note that here's a nice little Greyhawk note. Confusion to our enemies is a real world, you know, where real world quotation, and you know, a little exclamation that's used, you know, quite often before battle. And here we have, may our weapons prove potent and our enemy be confounded, to add to some sayings, you know, that we can throw into the setting. All right, I'm going to restart. It's the second paragraph from the end, page 312. Three men went to the doorway and peered inside. They could see a small landing that gave onto a flight of worn steps, heading to the right and descending into total darkness. "Here, Chert," said the druid as he fumbled in his belt and withdrew a small bag of black felt. From the bag he took a small glowing object that made the antechamber almost as bright as day. He reached up and touched it to the front of the barbarian's helmet, and there it stuck. "You have not the vision of elvenkind as I do. Neither Gord nor Yurg can see in darkness either. The lodestone will stay fast to the steel of your helmet, shedding its light, a magical illumination, neither hot nor flickering, for all us all to see by. Agreed?" Chert accepted readily, and the group proceeded ahead, delving below the grim cairn. Sword in hand, thought about the strange sort of sight his weapon bestowed upon him, but did not mention it to his companions. Break. Now this is the end of the chapter. I always like to break. Then this is end of chapter 29, but also now we can give a little comment about you know, there's a little design here for the cairn, if we wanted to use it. And then also a very smart move there is enchanting a lodestone, a magnet, with you know, a continual light spell, so that it can be stuck to a piece of armor, like Chert's helm. And now, the old picture we had of Chert did not show a helm, and we can see here where Gord would have been well off to have a helm after being struck in the head here. But this is the first mention, I think, of that. Now, we also have Gord mentioning that his sword, I assume it's the short sword that was gifted to him by, you know, Dunstan, Count Blamu. And, you know, that had all sorts of abilities. I didn't remember that it gifted him with, you know, infravision or some kind of dark sight.
Yeah, but it enhanced his vision. I think when he put it on around the...
time of and the, by the aid of that short sword, he became aware of it as well as it being more visible to him. I don't know if it allows him to see invisibility. I don't think the wolfware was projecting anything such as that. I just think in general, as a you know, a magical wolf lycanthrope, that it is much more you know, has a great ability to hide itself. All right.
Oh, I was thinking about it too, though. He said he didn't mention it to his companions, but I was like, oh, well, Gord's got that. He should be okay, but he kept it to himself.
Yes, and it's also one of its abilities was piercing armor, you know, even up to dragon scale.
Right.
And it makes me wonder if the armor, and it, I would think it likely that the armor on the zombie from the dead cleric might have been magical. You know, now, if we look and we see that Chert's axe has combat enchantment, you know, where it strikes true and seems to do a critical hit. And you know, here you've up on the fiction channel here, where you can, you know, add commentary or, you know, put things, you know, Chris has put up a short history of critical hits in D&D, a little article.
There's some interesting stuff in it.
Yeah, yeah, and well worth looking into, you know, which is something that you can come back to. If you are looking at the archives on the Cannon Fire website, we maybe down the road we can transfer some of this information over to the text form on the Cannon Fire website. All right, I'm going to restart. It is chapter 30, page number 314, and the first paragraph. Ancient steps were hewn from the rock of the mountain itself, their chiseled edges worn smooth over the ages by persons or things that these adventurers could not guess at. Kurt led the way, followed by Curly Greenleaf, Gord, and then the huge bear, who had some difficulty squeezing his bulk through the narrow confines of the place. The quartet descended slowly, each member keeping within two or three steps of the others at all times. Gord kept count of the steps as he negotiated them, and reached the bottom and the number 90 at the same time. Three men fanned out at the end of the stairway, slowly turning to survey the place they had found beneath the stone barrow. They were in a natural cave, a domed grotto of circular shape. The roof of the cave was hung with long stalactites, and the floor was dotted with mounds that looked like rounded-off stalagmites, as if something had passed over them frequently. Leaning against the wall nearby were several pitch-covered pieces of wood, obviously a store of torches left there long ago. Three passages led away from this large chamber, the entrance to each showing evidence of having been shaped by tools in some distant age. One was directly across from the stair, while the other two offered egress to the left and the right. None of these dark passages seemed more or less promising than the others. Which led to the demon's lair? Which to the hidden relic? Perhaps none or all. Let's go straight ahead, suggested Gord. If we come to any branches, we always turn right. That way we can never lose our way. His two companions agreed, and the great bear simply followed the druid. The four went to the arch entry to the chosen passage and looked cautiously down its length. The magical light shed by the lodestone affixed a church steel cap allowed them to see 60 feet into the tunnel, formed of a combination of natural and worked stone. Break. All right, so, you know, here we're getting some physical description of the cairn. You know, 90 steps down, chamber with at the base with three branching outlets from it. I believe that on the first floor where they fought the zombie, there had been more than this one branch leading to the stair, but there, I thought there was more than one, but honestly, from yesterday, I just don't remember offhand. But we are getting, you know, a physical description of this cairn, and obviously something that, you know, we can quickly, you know, write up and use as a little adventure locale. It's unique in that, you know, it has this connection to the story, and if you're running something with it, you know, it's got a little history behind it, so I think it would be particularly fun to do a little write-up of it. It's not so far, you know, a big, you don't know what's in any passages they haven't encountered, but so far they've had the one real encounter. And we're leading down the passages, and you don't know what else is going to be in here. It's not a big dungeon crawl, I don't think. So, you know, it's just a small, what you might say is a side encounter, but of very high level.
I liked a couple of things that he was doing with his thieving skills, such as counting the steps and then formulating a plan so they wouldn't get lost.
Yeah, and you know, that has been a very big thing, is that we are getting a lot of showing the various skills being used, and I, you know, I've enjoyed that all through this, is Gygax is illustrating all the things in the game that you can that the various abilities that these characters have. Now, I'm not sure, but I believe the Barbarian write-up limits, what kind of magical items a Barbarian would use or be comfortable with.
Yeah, so, low-level Barbarians have a disaffinity towards magic.
Yeah, so it was kind of interesting to me that it is Chert who is wearing the magical light stone and that he accepted it readily. The inherited, rule, his axe, that can, kind of be led to that in his early days, if his father was still alive, then he wouldn't have been using it until his, father ended his life or adventuring career. And so...
Yeah, if he had seen his father using it, he wouldn't be afraid of it.
Yeah. So that can, be... And one of the things to keep in mind with AD&D is that there are plenty of character exceptions. The game, right away from the DMG, it always was in the hands of the DM that if you did not like a rule, change it, make it yours. And, the whole Greyhawk setting is built on that theme, is make it yours. So it's always been a very do-it-yourself game and a do-it-yourself setting. As the game progressed, I think that's one of the sad things, is that there was less encouragement for DMs and players to, really use their own imagination, especially DMs. All right. I'm going to restart. It is page number 315 and paragraph 4. A faint stirring of the air brought to their noses a putrid odor, a nauseating mixture of decay and foulness. Jurg snorted as the scent struck his nostrils. Then the bear pushed past the humans, heading down the broad passageway at a fast shuffle. Gord, Chert, and Greenleaf followed quickly, passing through the entrance one by one, and then moving into a line abreast, once past that stricture. The corridor was about 6 paces wide, more than sufficient space for the 3 men to travel and fight side by side, with Gord on the left, Greenleaf in the center, and Chert on the right. They followed the bear, keeping within 2 or 3 paces of Jorg's flanks. Now I'm breaking right here because, 6 paces, obviously isn't 6 feet, I'm guessing, cause I would imagine, that, hexes were normally 10 by 10. And I think they always allowed like two people to be able to, walk down a 10 by 10 corridor, shoulder to shoulder. But, for example, Chert is wielding an axe. I certainly wouldn't want to be next to him, even in a 10 by 10 space, with a giant-sized barbarian, using a two-handed axe. I'm not sure what Gygax means by pieces, then. It might be like a full... it might be instead of like a foot, it might be a full pace then, which, depending on the size of the person, would be several feet, so this could be as much as like 12, 15 or more feet that he's talking about at 6 paces. If there's enough for a 3-foot stride, don't know, that's pretty big stride. But I think it's much more than 6 feet. And even then, I'm a little leery of the idea that the three of them can fight abreast, you know, in a passageway like that.
The last time we took a break, I complimented Gord, but here I'm going to take a shot. I think he should really be checking for traps.
Yeah, I mean, I think that should definitely be mentioned inside this cairn. Now, we haven't seen anything but of traps yet, but nothing has been searched for. There's been no looking for secret doors or passages. There's no checking out for traps. And yet, this seems like the optimal place where you would find traps.
Especially with Gary. I mean, if you have any familiarity with Tomb of Horrors, you should know Gary likes to use traps. And
Yeah. I mean, that is a crap mess. Although, right. I don't think he wrote Tomb of Horrors.
Oh, okay.
I know it was a convention module. In fact, if you pick up the deluxe version of Art and Arcana, which is a book about the history of TSR. This is the big one that's a slipcase version. There is bound within it a small booklet that is the original tournament version of Tomb of Horrors.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a very nice little piece. And I would think that it is, I don't think it was a Gygax. I mean, I
thought it was.
I believe Gygax wrote, you know, he wrote T1, and I believe he wrote the G series, and maybe the D series as well. But I didn't think Tomb of Horrors was Gygax. I may be wrong.
Yeah.
And then here, Chris has posted on the fiction chat, text chat, that about the barbarians, that in general they detest magic and those who use it. They will, at low levels, refuse to employ any sort of magic item if they recognize it as such, and will often seek to destroy magic items, and if successful, will receive experience points awards. And initially, they shun magic users, although, you know, that, and view with suspicion, even clerical spells, except... And always viewed with clerical spells of the type used by shamans and witch doctors. Oh, the types used by shamans and witch doctors are not so viewed. And here I would add druids, of course, onto that, which seem to show a natural, in my mind, rangers and barbarians and druids are all kind of linked together. And obviously, with the description of the Adri Forest, the woods folk seem to be druids and rangers and barbarians for their combat classes. All right. I'm going to restart. It's page number 315 and the third from the end. Once they were 30 or 40 feet inside the passage, the light revealed a wall in the distance. They were coming to an intersection where the way was no longer straight. Paths curved to the left and the right, which gave the men their first opportunity to put Gord's procedure into action. But Jurg knew nothing of such intentions, nor would he have cared if he had. The bear lumbered ahead and into the left corridor without hesitation. "His nose tells him which way to go," said the druid quietly to his companions, as they trotted to keep up with the animal. "So that's the way we go, too." The passage curved gently and seemed to be heading back in the general direction of the grotto they had just left. The clicking of the bear's claws and the pounding of the men's leather heels on the stone floor raised faint echoes around them. The vaulted ceiling of the passageway sent those sounds bouncing back and forth in a confusing manner. The noise did not seem to distract Jurg in the least, for he went on without pause, veering to the right into another straight tunnel. When the corridor they were trotting branched in a Y shape, Jurg began to feel himself losing all sense of distance and direction, as their ursine bloodhound took them right yet again into another curving branch of the passage, then along one more straight course before suddenly coming to a halt in front of another intersection. He pauses to sniff out which way the demon lies, the druid said. Phew, Chert replied and spat as he did so. This reeking stench is so foul that the thing must be everywhere. Georg swung his barrel-like head back and forth several times, making snorting and snuffling sounds with his nose, then held his snout, pointed to the left for a long second. With a grunt, the monstrous cave bear moved forward again, slowly this time, holding his nose close to the chiseled stone beneath them as he took the left-hand branch. All right, break. So, two things like that really strike me is one, the ability of the cave bear to act as like a bloodhound, and that its sense of smell is much finer than, say, even, you know, Chert the Barbarians. And then secondly, we're getting quite a meandering map being built of curving, various curving and straight passages, work stone and, natural walls. So that's a little bit of direct lore that you can use in creating this is a little dungeon adventure, and also something to add to the characteristics of a cave bear if they're not already mentioned.
Yeah, right. I like Yurik.
Yeah. So it is something I'd like to see, worked out. All right. There's quite a bit to go here, so I'm going to just keep reading, but I don't think we're going to finish.
Oh, my gosh. 6:52 again.
I know. Time is just flying by. All right, I'm going to restart, and it is page number 316, and the fourth paragraph from the end. Suddenly, the sound of a high-pitched giggle enveloped the group, making the human start. At this, Yurg growled loudly, and the bear's mane of fur bristled. Ord felt horripilations on his head as well. Walking stiffly, baring his teeth and growling, the bear went on, closely followed by the three men. They would all soon face the demonic catabaline in what the men presume would be a fight to the death. After what seems hundreds of yards, but was certainly not that far, the curved walls of the passage once more offered a choice of direction. The correct one was evident to all at this point, however, for a dull blue-violet luminosity pervaded the air in the tunnel to the right. Then the light faded, and again laughter sounded. Neither chuckle nor malign giggle this time, but a sweet peal of melodious laughter, seductively feminine and appealing, gently echoing down the passage. The bear snarled but continued to move slowly. After exchanging glances of uncertainty, the men followed. All right, break. Yes, horripilation. I have never run into that word before, and I have, as I've read this book seven times, but I've never noted it. The other thing that we get here, the front cover is showing a picture of the demon and the blue glow surrounding it, which is now reflecting from the tunnel that they're right. And the light fades and, shifts in intensity, according to this paragraph here. And then they have traveled at least some distance, in these winding passages. Gygax mentions, it feels like it's hundreds of yards. But that is, again, just the sensation, which even Gord feels is incorrect, that it must be a shorter distance. but their trepidation, and reluctance to proceed further. Yes, and there we have up on the Greyhawk Fiction the bluish glowing demon from the front cover. All right, we're very close to the end. I'm going to continue right here, but I'm not sure we're really going to come to the combat section. After only a few dozen more paces, the passage turned sharply and opened into a large and beautiful cavern. The four of them arrived at the entranceway at virtually the same time. And at that instance, a woman's voice boomed out, "Welcome, strangers." The speaker was standing in the center of the oval place, arms spread wide in greeting. "Since my little tricks failed to dissuade you, I have no choice but to surrender myself to your mercies, trusting that you will not slay or abuse me." This statement seemed preposterous to Gord, for the glowing blue horror which towered before them appeared capable of rending the huge cave bear to bits. Further, he could not understand why this gruesome monster spoke with a female voice through its lipless, fanged mouth. Perhaps this was an irony of condition, for never before had he seen anything so foully evil, ugly, and terrible. The dulcet voice made the horror of this demon more awful still. "May I come from this place of safety, sirs?" it continued. "Have I your pledge that you will not hurt me?" "Stay where you stand, woman," Curly Greenleaf ordered. "If you move from that little isle in your lagoon, we will surely slay you. Even naked and helpless as you appear." Gord, feeling himself becoming confused, nudged the druid at this point, but Greenleaf ignored the contact and went on. "We seek a Catabaline, a demon of fearsome power. If you are not such, prove it by telling us where this fiend lurks. We might spare you." "Are you cold?" interjected the barbarian, as he stared at the figure in the center of the cavern. Now Gord's head was swimming. Woman, naked and helpless, lagoon, cold. What were his companions talking about? Scaled and wrinkled demon that leered from huge horizontal pupiled eyes at bear and men was certainly naked of clothing, but it was most certainly not female, as far as human standards went. And from where Gord stood, the thing seemed comfortable as its splayed clawed feet rested on the rock of the cavern's hard surface, a floor that displayed not the slightest trace of water, but which was strewn with a welter of bones, skulls, and other undefinable litter. All right, I think this is a good stopping place. We're not going to jump into here at any further, but I'd like to note here, I believe this is more of the enchantment of that sword. I'm thinking... he possessed the sword, I guess, during the Wolfware encounter. And I'm wondering if the female form that was shown. Now, Caldwell, he drew a picture of the wolf form and then behind it a naked woman. And I'm wondering at the similarity here if the Wolfware was able to... was able, like this demon, to project an illusion of a naked woman so that he could, get it, catch Gord and anybody else unprepared.
When she was singing, that siren song.
That's right. There was also the singing. And I think when we looked at the stuff about the Wolfware, that it was not, the write-up does not have it as being able to charm through singing. And here it's noted that both horripilation and ordure are things that, one of the commenters here has said that had never seen in a novel before. And I've heard hors d'oeuvre used in several things, but never horripilation.
No.
All right. This, you know, we're not at near the end of the chapter, so I'm not going to push on much further. I believe it's page, we're ending here on page 317. That, you know, the whole book is 352 pages, including an afterword that is about several different things, but it is not the story anymore. So we are so close to the end of this, you know, because at this point we are 35 pages from the end of the book.
Wow.
And I'm, you know, the last, like I said, the last five or so pages are, you know, not story. So I really think that what we're looking at here is just in a few more days, we should be done with Saga of Old City. And that'll be just absolutely amazing. All right. I'm going to call up Craig, our record bot. I mentioned the final page we're on because I want to go back and add that information in a separate posting beside all these recordings so that we can use the reference index to Saga of Old City and be able to find what recordings cover, what pages are in the various recordings. All right. Well, good night. And, you know, thanks for some people for listening. And Chris says, it's going to be archived on Canon Fire. And I hope people enjoy it. This is 42 hours of recordings plus here. So quite a bit. And I'm not sure if people are going to be jumping in from the beginning, but hopefully you can realize that you don't really need to. You can just listen to the subjects. You can listen to about the René or Stoink or the Atloy or the Battle of Woodford, which is, you know, extremely interesting. You can listen to this last end section here. You know, so there are, like, there's the whole story, but there are different sections of it. And so, you know, you can choose to listen to it from beginning to end, or else you can just pick and choose the sections of the book. We've done this as a commentary. There's much more commentary than dramatic text. It would only be about 8 hours to read this whole thing without the commentary, so you're seeing how much has been added to it. Well, good night.
Good night.